Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we'll revisit a conversation with Derek Black about their new book, The Klansman's Son. Derek Black was raised to take over the white nationalist movement in the United States. Their father, Don Black, was a former Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan and started Stormfront, the internet's first white supremacist website. Derek built the Kids page. Then, while in college in 2013, Derek publicly renounced white nationalism and apologized for their actions and the suffering they had caused. The majority of their family stopped speaking to them. They disappeared into academia. But in 2016, as they watched the rise of Donald Trump, they immediately recognized what they were hearing, spread and mainstreaming of the hate they had helped cultivate, and they knew they couldn't stay silent. We'll revisit our conversation with Derek Black from May of this year following the news.
This episode of Access Utah was first broadcast in May of this year.
Thanks for joining us for Access Utah. Tom Williams. Today we're going to talk with Derek Black about their new book, The Klansman's Son. Derek Black was raised to take over the white nationalist movement in the United States. And their father, Don Black, was a former Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan and started Stormfront, the internet's first white supremacist website. Derek built the Kids page. David Duke was also their close family friend and mentor. Racist hatred, though often wrapped up in respectability, was all Derek knew. Then, while in college in 2013, Derek publicly renounced white nationalism and apologized for their actions and the suffering they had caused. The majority of their family stopped speaking to them. They disappeared into academia, convinced they had done so much harm there was no place for them in public life. But in 2016, as they watched the rise of Donald Trump, they immediately recognized what they were hearing, the spread and mainstreaming of hate that they had helped cultivate, and they knew they couldn't stay silent. Derek Black is a doctoral student in history at the University of Chicago, researching the medieval and early modern origins of the concept of race and racist hierarchies and ideologies. And since 2016, they've spoken to many audiences in universities, foundation institutions, museums, synagogues, and churches, many media outlets as well. Derek Black, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me on today.
First book here, The Klansman's Son, getting a lot of publicity. Congratulations on the book.
Thanks so much. It's a really strange experience. I've been working on it for several years now, and it's very odd to have it out in the world.
Yeah, that very timely as well. You start in the book. I'd like to start there as well. Your prologue is a experience you had 10 years old. I guess finally convincing your dad, you'd see him on media, and you wanted to be on media as well, right? And so he finally said, okay, you can come with me to the Jenny Jones show, which is kind of a Jerry Springer-like show, right? Tell me a bit about that experience.
Yeah, it was one of those shows where the audience would yell at the people who came out.
Yeah. Although, I guess, your dad had made an agreement that you wouldn't be subject to that. You'd have an interview, behind a screen or something. Tell me a bit about that experience.
It's very strange to look back on. Like, at the time, I genuinely believed that I was responsible and very adult and that I believed in their ideology. And I look back on it, and at my age now, as an adult, I cannot imagine telling a 10-year-old that, you know, as long as you consent to this, then you can clearly fully understand the consequences. But that doesn't change the fact that at the time I felt like, I was saying yes. My dad asked me over and over up until the day of the interview if I was sure I wanted to do it, and he made sure to tell me that I could back out, and I didn't. It was this really terrifying experience, but it also felt really independent, and it felt like I was being someone who made my parents proud and who made my broader community proud.
I think you would, at least your 10-year-old self would say you generally did pretty well. You talked about your heritage, right? That you didn't hate, right? You did mess up and use the word racist, and you weren't supposed to use that word, right?
Yeah, it was amazing. I had not gone back to rewatch it really in years, and so I went to try to watch it to write this book, and I initially couldn't get through it. I had to have someone else transcribe it for me, and that was the thing that struck me first, was hearing myself say the word racist, because for the decade after that, as I was a teenager and I gave more and more interviews to newspapers and television shows and documentaries, I remember recognizing that we don't say this word. It was a really firm position that my family had, that they were very careful about the words they used. They said racialist, not racist. And so looking at myself at 10 years old, trying to get into the middle of this, thinking about it as the thing that set me down that path, I couldn't believe that I had used the wrong word. And it all came flooding back, remembering my parents sitting me down saying, oh, you know, that was a really good interview, but we need to, you know, talk about some of the terminology and how we don't use the enemy's wording.
And you emphasize family here. You loved your family. You wanted to stand up for them. And that day you say you felt like you had. That would come into play later on. We'll get into that. It's very, very hard to leave once you decide to leave because you're losing your family. I want to talk a bit about fascinating. You write about how your father got into the movement as a young man, David Duke, your mother, and talking about why they joined this movement. And one key factor was, I think all of those, David Duke, your father, your mother, felt like and talked about how they were swimming in some of these ideas just as part of mainstream ideas, right? In the South, at least, right? White supremacy.
Yeah, and that was the lesson that they really took into their movement activism, that none of them had grown up in radical movements. They all grew up in relatively average white middle-class families in the South. And I always like to add that, you know, the South doesn't have any monopoly on racism, but they were all growing up in the 1960s and seeing the civil rights movement happening around them. And their relatively normal middle-class parents were against the civil rights movement and had these sort of casual racist beliefs, but didn't want to make a big spectacle of themselves, wanted to just segregate themselves in more quiet ways. And their parents criticized them not for having these racist beliefs, but for going out and doing these radical things like joining a Nazi movement or a Klan movement. And they didn't understand why they were ruining their professional and personal lives by being so outspoken. And my parents and David, their explanation was, as teenagers, they thought if these were going to be the beliefs that they learned from their community, if they were going to go out and try to justify them and learn what sort of facts that they think they thought they could argue, which was all false science, but if they could try to justify that worldview, then they didn't feel like it was acceptable to just be passive about it. They were had this very clear sense of what they thought was right and moral. And they took these sort of passive community ideas and took them to their logical extreme.
There's a fascinating passage in the book, your mother with David Duke, and your mother was married to David Duke first, right, before mm-hmm. she met your father. So mm-hmm. this is the young David Duke, your mother. I'll just quote this. David Duke remembers telling your mother, or her telling him, soon after they'd met, that she readily understood that if the white race was not preserved, neither could conservative principles be saved. And I guess that kind of was a part of the stew as well.
Mm-hmm. Both of them had met in college. My dad and David met when they were teenagers on their first road trip on a carpool that was organized by a Nazi conference to go to their first white nationalist event. And my mother and David were going to Louisiana State University and met each other there and became activists and married right after college and founded a Klan organization. And they were both ideologues and they both became activists and tried to, all three of them became these central figures in trying to build that movement. And I think you're really right to emphasize their beliefs came from what seemed like more traditional conservative values with this sort of like casual racism. And the lesson they took from that was that they could reach out to that community. They could find people with more casual versions of those views and then just really talk to them and convince them to be much more extreme about it.
And I'm trying to, you're helping me and us kind of get into their heads. You know, these ideas are repugnant to many, but understanding how people drift into this movement, take up these beliefs and spread them. there's, I guess, one more passage from early in the book, and then we'll move on a little bit here. You talk about Joseph Paul Franklin, who became famous murdering, especially interracial couples, right, and was later captured and executed. He's quoted as saying, you just start hanging out with other people with similar beliefs. When you hang out with people who believe what you do, you're constantly reinforced. And once you consciously go over this stuff over and over again, it just goes down into your conscience. And you begin to think that blacks and Jews aren't even people at all. So in part, I guess it's a community. You're seeking out a community, I guess, then and now. Is that how people, come to drift into these movements?
Yeah, 100%. That was a quote that really struck me, because my family disavowed him my whole life. They had this idea about how he was this psychopath who had committed these murders. And to that extent, they were right. Like, they were people who tried to seek out politics, and they didn't use racial slurs. And by the time I had met them, they'd been trying to build this movement. But they also didn't distance themselves from the violence in the movement, because they couldn't, because it was inherent. It was the same ideology. And so when I was doing research and found that quote from him years later when he was in prison before he was executed, it just struck me how that is the statement that justifies and explains this entire movement, that the people who commit mass atrocities are doing it out of this sense of loyalty and identity and a feeling of being the only people in the world who know this secret about society, you know, this idea that America is founded as a white supremacist nation and that they have to stand up for this and that everybody else in the world is like what he called an evildoer. That core belief, even among the people who see themselves as pretty genteel and have academic degrees and white-collar jobs, it's that belief that anything can be justified because they're the ones who are being threatened that explains how this can become so extreme, so dangerous, and also be something that provides a home and gives a lot of meaning to a lot of people.
So you do talk in the book about how your father, you know, thought of himself, David Duke, etc. You yourself, white supremacy, white nationalism. How did you guys think about yourself?
So I try to disambiguate white supremacy and white nationalism as terms. And by that, I don't mean that white nationalists are not white supremacists. Like, they're deeply racist. They believe in hierarchy. They believe that white people are a superior group of people and smarter and aren't going to commit as many crimes. And to be clear, like, all of this is ridiculous, but they spend a lot of time trying to justify it. They want to believe they're not just people who have emotional reactions. They want to believe they're people who base their decisions on statistics, and they use terms like white nationalism or white power to define their movement. And I really try to emphasize that that term doesn't just mean racism. It doesn't just mean having anti-immigrant beliefs or being anti-black or just having these sort of like racist beliefs that are really far more common than I think people recognize in this country. And it means being a part of a movement that has an identity, that has heroes, that has martyrs, and goes back over 60 years and has this history of politics and violence and these revolutionary goals that are consistent over decades. And so if we're going to understand white nationalism and white power as this social movement that only really has tens of thousands of people but wields an enormous amount of social influence, it's just really important to recognize that people who are a part of that movement know they're a part of that movement. They know the other people. They have the babysitters for their kids, the people they marry, the people they hang out with and associate with are also members of this movement scattered throughout the country in just all the normal places that anybody lives. Like, white nationalists don't look different from anyone else, and there's no way to identify them beyond how they identify themselves.
So what's emphasized, I guess, more publicly, like your appearance on the Jenny Jones Show, et cetera, I guess maybe it would be on Stormfront and on the kids page that you set up. What you would say, I guess, we don't hate, right? It's not racism, it's racialism, it's heritage. But what were the goals? What are the goals of the movement?
So white nationalism is a movement that its ideology believes that race is true and real and a biological distinction between people that you can explain and prove through genetics and statistics. And all of that is pseudoscience, and it's essentially the same thing that was developed in the 19th century to sort of justify segregation. But white nationalists are heirs to that kind of segregation, and I think the easiest way to understand them is that they looked at the world as it was created after the Civil War, when society was segregated after the end of slavery to try to reimpose white supremacy, and they think that that wasn't extreme enough. What they want is global segregation. They'll tell themselves, and they tell other people, that that is why they are not white supremacists, because they just want to separate every race in the entire world, and therefore that means that nobody is going to be superior or lording over anyone else. And I think it's pretty easy to look at that from the outside and recognize the violence and the danger and the just hate and terror that their ideology wants to bring on the world. And I also just want to emphasize that when they call themselves white nationalists, they're never referring to America, and it's an international movement, and they're not referring to the UK or France or whatever country they're from. When they say white nationalism, they mean that race is the nation they're talking about, and they want to impose a society that is closest to Nazi Germany.
Which is terrifying in many ways, right?
Yeah.
So Ku Klux Klan, right? Your father was involved in that, at least for a time. David Duke, obviously. Neo-Nazis. When your father started up Stormfront, were there any changes? Obviously, you probably want to put a more polished face on a website like that.
Yeah. When I was born, he had already founded and then left a Klan group. I was born relatively late in both of my parents' lives, and he was trying to emphasize the sort of more mild approach, which I think is saying something, because white nationalism, even when they think that they're being approachable, is incredibly terrifying and often has swastikas and all these sort of violent anti-Semitic rhetoric. But nevertheless, he was trying to create this big tent by creating a website on the early World Wide Web and trying to bring in people who, he would always use the phrase, we're looking for people who start a sentence saying, I'm not racist, but, because whatever they say after the but is going to be just something that leads to the most extreme versions of white nationalist ideology. And so he would go on TV, he would give interviews, he would try to get people to see the domain name for his website, and the community where people could go and post and meet other people. And then once they were there, tell them that their beliefs, their bigotry, their discrimination, their stereotypes were not only okay, that they shouldn't accept anyone calling them racist or telling them that they were wrong or telling them that they needed to change or that the society around them needed to change. And from there, they could escalate to this whole worldview that tried to explain every aspect of global politics through the lens of an anti-Semitic conspiracy, through the lens of racism. And many people went down that path, and it became their entire community.
We'll go to break soon. I want to come back and talk about your experience in college. I think it's very, very important how you changed, right? Not easy, right? Because you're fearing losing your community, your family, which you did. But I want to take us to 2015, 2016, the rise of Donald Trump. I well remember David Duke coming out and saying, if you're a white nationalist, you have to support Donald Trump. He's going to be so good for us. What did you see, in I don't know, coded language or what Mr. Trump was saying or his supporters that I guess worried you?
I remember initially when he announced his campaign by talking about Mexican rapists and describing immigration as this invasion into America. And I immediately recognized, this is the sort of talking points that white nationalists use when they're trying to reach out to people. And by that, I don't think Donald Trump has ever identified himself as a part of the white nationalist movement. What I think he did was use a lot of the talking points that they had developed over decades. And that was very intentional on white nationalist part. their goal as a movement was to spread ideas and phrases and sort of be the only people in the room who were willing to say the unacceptably racist things. And they were aware that there were politicians, particularly after the civil rights movement in the 1960s, who were willing to sometimes court them, sometimes show up to their events, sometimes pay some sort of lip service to their movement, but they never saw any mainstream Republican politicians being willing to go far enough as far as they saw it. And so they continue to see themselves as being the only people who hold that most extreme version of the ideology. And every time anyone tries to tap into their base or use some of the beliefs they have, they use that as an on-ramp to become more powerful themselves. And I think that's exactly the role that Donald Trump has played. And that's what David Duke meant by telling white nationalists that they needed to support him, not because Donald Trump was a white nationalist, but because his movement would grow theirs.
I know some conservatives say, you know, not white nationalists, but conservatives say, hey, progressives, you've just overused the word racist. Everything we do is racist. And so, you know, they say, I'm just going to reject that. It holds no meaning for me anymore. Fine, I'm a racist. Do you think the progressives overused that word over time?
I think it can be a little complicated in how we use terminology. And I think that's even something that I've carried over from growing up in a movement that was deeply focused on what words to use. They were willing to drop any word that they thought was not working for them. And I think any activist movement should probably be open to that. But that said, I think that some of the ways that racist is used as a term these days can be really useful, particularly when it's describing inequalities, when it's describing the way that society really does great injustice to people based on their bodies, you know, based on whether they are born seeming to be a white person or born seeming to be a black person. Like, we live in a society where that is extremely predictive of how society is going to treat you, what resources you're going to have over your lifetime. Wealth is incredibly unequal. And I think that using racism in that way can be extremely useful. The observation that I made when I was writing this book and trying to look back and see how is it that people come to these extreme conclusions and justify white nationalism and dedicate their lives to it. And one that I think is really explanatory is that they grew up in a highly unequal society. Like, they grew up looking around, seeing that police treated people differently based on what group they were born into. And they were a group of people who had this sense of right and wrong, whether or not they applied it correctly. And while some people look at that and say, we need to right those injustices, we need to change society, we need to make it so that people don't face injustice based on who they are and how they're born, white nationalists looked at that same world and tried to explain why they didn't need to change, why they weren't the beneficiaries of some injustice or a social crime. And that pathway is actually a very similar one. It's a conclusion that tells you that you don't need to feel implicated in something bigger than yourself.
Well, let's take a break. We're talking with Derek Black, author of the new book, a fascinating book. It's called The Klansman's Son. We'll have more following this break.
This episode of Access Utah was first broadcast in May of this year.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with Derek Black, author of the new book, The Klansman's Son. Derek Black was raised to take over the white nationalist movement in the United States. Their father, Don Black, was a former Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan, started Stormfront, the Internet's first white supremacist website. Derek built the kids page. Then, while in college in 2013, Derek publicly renounced white nationalism and apologized for their actions and the suffering they had caused. And so Derek Black writes about this and much more in The Klansman's Son. So, Derek Black, I want to take you to college now. You went to New College in Florida?
Yeah, I did. The small liberal arts college in Sarasota, Florida, a public school.
So as I understand, as you write, you kind of kept your head down, at least the first year, I guess, right? You were just very nice student, Derek Black. When did things start leaking out that you were actually connected to Stormfront, etc.?
It was actually in the second half of my first year at the college. It wasn't new to me to not bring up this part of my life. I had started a personal web page the year before. I started one for kids. When I was 9 years old, I was writing about Spider-Man and tornadoes and writing about my niece as a baby. And I thought that I could have both of those things. And for most of my homeschooled years, I would go out and do extracurricular things or volunteer or be in sort of social scenes. And people typically agreed. They just would, if they would see me on TV or something, they would just drop it when I said I didn't want to talk about it. And I expected that that would be true at college too, until I got there and realized that I was making these relationships with people who they were sharing with me intimate details about their life and how white supremacy and anti-Semitism was directly affecting them, because a lot of the people I was making very close relationships with were not white. And I was realizing bit by bit that this is going to feel like an enormous betrayal when they do find out my background, when they do find out who I am, and when they do find out what I've been keeping from them. And then that's exactly what happened in the second semester when an upper year student found an article about me and posted it on the student email forum.
Well, what were the range of reactions? I guess it would be, hey, you need to leave school, or what were the range of reactions from students?
There were basically three major reactions between the student body, and it was a small school. It was about 800 students, and people couldn't escape knowing what was happening. It wasn't possible to just be in your own social scene, and it became this massive thread. The three main immediate reactions happened within hours. I was studying abroad and just sort of reading this and not replying. The first one was this sort of free speech argument that, you know, this may be repulsive, but everyone has a right to believe and say whatever they want. And as long as they're not causing a problem on this campus, then who are we to tell somebody what they should or should not believe? Another one that came right after that was, we have a right, we have an obligation to speak up for our values and also defend members of the community who feel threatened by having a white nationalist student, not just somebody who grew up in this, but somebody who I had run for office the year before. But at that point, I still firmly believed this ideology. I thought it was factual and right. And their argument was, we have no obligation to try to let every voice be heard if we have students here who are feeling intimidated and terrified. And it is our right as students to say, we don't want you here. And that was a strong and loud voice. And then the last one was probably smaller, but also very present, was this idea that college changes people. And maybe I was there and committed to the community and not willing to leave. Maybe that meant that they could change my mind.
And I want to emphasize that last one. That's important, right? And there's a particular fellow student named Allison who, I guess, kind of spearheads this. Let's engage with Derek. Maybe we can convince him.
Yeah, no, that was actually the reaction that at the time, and especially once I got to the end of college, and, you know, I don't want to spoil the book, but like condemning my family's belief system and bit by bit having learned why everything I thought was a fact was not accurate. Allison was a roommate of Matthew Stevenson, another person who I had gotten to know that first semester, who was observantly Jewish and practiced Shabbat dinners every Friday night in his dorm. And he invited me over when I first got back to campus, and he didn't want to argue with me. He actually told everybody at the dinner not to bring it up, not to even acknowledge that they knew this fact about me, even though they'd all read articles about me and gone online and looked at my posts on my dad's website. And Allison was his roommate, and I remember that first night her coming back and realizing that this is a student, unlike the people who have invited me, who is practicing the ideal of ostracism, because she showed up and they said, oh, you know, Allison, do you want to sit down with us? You want to have dinner with us? Here's Derek Black. And she just looked ahead, did not look at me, did not acknowledge me, and just walked forward and went to her room and proceeded to do that for the next few months while I was coming over regularly to continue going to these weekly dinners.
So not an easy thing, right? When did you start I guess, thinking, okay, this ideology that I've embraced up to this point might be wrong. How did that happen?
It was through conversations with her, at least explicitly, after a while, and she just realized nobody on this campus was actually talking to me about my ideology. She knew the people who wanted to make me feel unwelcomed were effectively doing that, giving me middle fingers in any kind of student gathering and taking my name off members' lists for student organizations, but that she knew nobody either at the Shabbat dinners or just broadly at campus was talking to me because people, it was a small enough campus that you could sort of find out what was going on. And her initial question was, would you be willing to just tell me how it is that you can believe this hateful ideology that I have heard you believe and I have heard you on the radio saying, and also that you show up to these Shabbat dinners and that you are really a good friend to students who your family's ideology say don't have a place in this country. Like, that just seems completely incompatible. And I was a kind person, and she knew that I wasn't unsafe, and she knew that I wasn't a dangerous person. And she was also, I think it's important to point out, was white herself and was not Jewish herself. So her relationship to feeling dehumanized by this ideology, she knew it was horrifying, and she was supporting her friends, and she didn't want people to feel ostracized or alienated on campus, but she personally was not feeling attacked or alienated by it, and she knew that she could sort of sit with that a little bit easier than people who were arguing for their own humanity if they were trying to debate with me.
I want just a brief talk about dehumanization. That's essentially what a lot of the white nationalists' ideology is. Although, if you're in that, you probably don't embrace that part of it, right? You're just saying we're taking the logical extension of our ideas, and maybe not leaning into that, dehumanizing the other group.
They definitely try to rationalize it, and that was something that made it possible. I was going to say easier, but I think possible for me to grow up as somebody who wanted to be open to being friends, being close to anyone, didn't want to exclude anyone from my life before I knew them. And it made it easier that major parts of this community tried to take this position that they didn't hate anyone, they didn't want harm to befall anyone, that my dad banned violent language on his website so he could always say he wasn't responsible for all the violent attacks that came out of this ideology, often by people who posted on his website. And I could say that I was being loyal and committed to this community and also say that I wasn't trying to be somebody who harmed other people. And that being Allison's first question was one that started to chip away immediately in a way that I look back and I recognize it had already started happening because I had made these close relationships with people. And once they knew who I was and were outing me on campus, and I started seeing these messages saying that I was not only ignorant and really sort of deceptive for not telling this about myself, but also that they thought I was wrong. They thought I was ignorant. They thought I was stupid. And they didn't think I was scary. They knew me. They knew that I wasn't, they knew that I could be a good friend. And they also realized that these things I believed were just horrible. And that first experience, it wasn't the first time people had told me that racism was wrong. It wasn't the first time that people had sent me messages even saying that. I had grown up with my inbox being filled with those kind of messages. But those were always people who were in the distance, who didn't know me, who I could dismiss and say, oh, you don't understand us. Like, if you just recognize that this is maybe unfortunate facts, and I wish it could be different or something like that, some sort of like, honestly, very arrogant message. But at college, they were people who I knew and respected. And when I was hearing them say that I was propagating an ideology that actively hurt them and made their lives worse, it was a message that I couldn't dismiss because I was committed to the community. I felt like I was a part of it. And so when I started talking with Allison, my initial question back to her, when I started explaining, oh, here are the facts that I think support this ideology, my question back to her was, is there some kind of misunderstanding? Is there some way that I can explain myself that people will see that I'm not actively trying to be what they think I am. And I think I knew even then, but over time, it took a long time to be able to admit that there was no misunderstanding there. I needed to wrestle with if my values were going to be someone who does not harm my friends, does not exclude people from my life, then I needed to change what I was saying and doing.
It's fascinating, the book, seeing you as you portray your struggle. It's not only intellectual, it's emotional, right? At a certain point, you write a letter, right? Or write a statement, which then gets leaked to the press, which you suspect it might do, where you're essentially trying to have it both ways, kind of going up to the line but not crossing it. It fascinating to see, and then obviously later on you make a complete break, but not an easy thing to do.
No, and you're right. There were two statements that I made over these like 2 or 3 years that I'd had these conversations with Allison in private, and we agreed we would talk, and I could give my positions and these things that I thought were factual. She could go and do research and come back and say there is no basis for race. Like, here is a bunch of studies that show race is not a genetic thing. Statistics do not show any differences in IQ. Race is a social experience. And then I would have to, one by one, take those things out of my toolbox and say, okay, I don't want to have a bad fact. I don't want to be using bad facts. And they felt maybe hard, and it took months to have those conversations. But getting to the end, realizing I didn't have an argument to justify what was hurting so many people, made me realize and have to actually face the fact that all that justification had been in the service of trying to maintain these relationships with my family and with their larger community. And it was about my identity. And I didn't want to face that. I wanted to be someone who probably initially could have it both ways, have both of these communities, be a good friend, a good supporter, a good someone who cared about both of these communities, because I knew I cared about both of those people. And I didn't want to lose the relationships, like every relationship that I had built up until I was 21. It became this experience where I started realizing that beliefs, really not just for me, but for a lot of people, have this function of being something that serves our identity and does keep us connected to our communities. They're often not as dangerous and often not as hateful or extreme, but our worldviews, the things that are really fundamental to who we are the things that if we were to fundamentally change them, it would often mean losing the community connections that we've built throughout our lives. And I think when we understand changing your mind as losing your sense of self and your relationships to other people, then we can see why it's so rare and why it's so hard, but also at the same time see that it's possible and see how it happens.
And I think that's a big part of why people are finding your story so hopeful, that it is possible, right? Sometimes we think it's not possible, but it is possible. Before we go to another break, I wonder if you talk about your story is a model, your friends engaging with you, understanding, I guess, on a certain level that you might lose your original community, so you need to have a community to go to. Can we scale that model up to get people out of these hurtful ideologies?
I actually think we can. It's not something that is easy to scale necessarily. And a few years ago, I spent several months working at Facebook, and we were working on trying to see if there are ways that you can sort of encourage people to have these sort of cross-cutting relationships where they build emotional ties to people and maybe challenge some of the things and biases and things they've experienced, not always just something bad and hateful. And that wasn't a project that went anywhere, but it was something that made me recognize that what we mean when we say scaling up, changing your mind, it's harder than just doing a tech platform, but it's also something that happens in our lives all the time. I think my experience happened at college, and I think that's a very common experience where people move and they go and live in close proximity with a bunch of people who are not from where they grew up, who are not closely tied to the communities of their families. and have different ideas and different backgrounds, and you have to sort of reconcile that, and you get close and you understand people and you come to care about them. And I think a lot of people have had that experience of sort of having this feeling of seeing the world differently, seeing themselves differently, like going home at Thanksgiving and being sort of surprised to hear the things that used to sound normal at the table and realizing that they sound sort of strange now. But it's not just college. Like, I think we can all think of different experiences when life phases, when people have kids and they join new communities, sometimes when people move, sometimes being diagnosed with a disease and finding a community of people to sort of support it, having other shifts in your life. Like, there are lots of different moments, and I don't think it's tied to being 18, 19 years old. I don't think it's tied to going to college. I think it's tied to changing your relationships to other people and really having the time to see them as full people. And if we think about it like that, we can see lots of different experiences when that happens. And you can also maybe imagine new ones. You can imagine having more intentional times in people's lives where they have an opportunity, even for a few weeks or a few months, to go somewhere and live close with people who and work with people that they've never known before and really build those ties and see how that can change and affect people's relationships. I think there's a thousand ways you can imagine it, and I don't want to be a social engineer, but the basic principle, I think, is there, and we can all kind of see those scenarios.
Let's take another break. We'll come back with a brief final segment with Derek Black, author of the new book, The Klansman's Son. That's out and available now. We'll have more following this break.
This episode of Access Utah was first broadcast in May of this year.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We've reached a last segment, a brief segment here, be 5 or 6 minutes. We're talking with Derek Black. Their new book is The Klansman's Son. Fascinating book, well worth the read, and very timely. So this last segment, Derek Black, I want to have you maybe talk a bit about the current situation, what's happening now. Of course, we've got an election, a very consequential election. One of the candidates, former President Trump, has pretty openly reached out to, without formally inviting in white nationalist groups, certainly kind of left the door open, right? So I guess it's probably troubling to you.
No, it continues to be extremely frightening to me. I have, since the first presidential campaign that he ran, or not his first campaign, but the first one that he won in 2016, I've been speaking out, trying to just say what it is that I experience within this movement, the ways that it's not marginal because its ideas are just alien to our culture. I think sometimes, like after Charlottesville, or maybe even after the January 6th insurrection, you would sometimes hear this message like, oh, these are not our American values. Like, these are not part of who we are. This is some sort of like outside group or extremists, and it's this threat of a very small number of people. And to some extent, that can be true. Charlottesville was an experience where we all saw really hundreds of people, but in the grand scheme, not that many, marching and shouting Nazi slogans. And yet their message resonated even in the White House, even Donald Trump at the time, saying there are good people on both sides, because their ideas, while they seem extreme in the moment, can resonate with much, much greater people, groups of people than I think a lot of people in the mainstream who are more committed to at least an idea of anti-racism are willing to recognize. And I think that is the message that I really try to say now, as we're going into another presidential campaign where the white nationalist movement is not powerful because they have lots of money. They're not powerful because they have millions of people or an army or any of these things or any of their like grand ideas about revolution. They're powerful because racism, anti-Semitism, just various forms of othering and extremism are something that has power to explain people's worlds, that has power to explain inequalities that are extremely uncomfortable to live with for anyone on either side of it. I think we sometimes forget the harm that can come from injustice when it seems like the person is the person being advantaged by it. But it is awful to live in a world where you feel like things are stacked for or against you. And one way to justify that is to say, oh, everybody else is blaming you. Everybody else is saying that you are responsible for this. And that's not a message that I want to tell anyone. It's not a message that I believe. I think that we all have a commitment to, or an obligation to be committed to trying to make the world better. But I don't think that anybody's responsible for the world that we've been given. What we're responsible for is the choices we make next. And I think it's it can be banal. It can be very mundane to make a choice to support a very radical, a very hateful, and a very dangerous movement and a very dangerous future for our entire society.
Well, just a little under a minute left. You're a doctoral student now. What's your hope? What's your plan?
I really try to lean into history. It took me a long time trying to think about what is a space that I can try to be helpful. And people sometimes ask me what I think anyone should do. And I never try to give anyone advice other than something. Because I look back at my college experience, I look back even at my family's activism, and the lesson that I took from that is that nothing ever changes unless we are concerted and really lean into our values to try to change it. And if you see something that is wrong in the world, leaning in and speaking up is the most powerful thing we can do, and we all have a different point of contact. People in my college were not necessarily trying to make some great change. They were just leaning into what they saw was right and the people they cared about around them and trying to make the next best choice. And I think that's what we can all do. And we all have some different position in our lives and wherever we are and whatever stage we're in, where we can just not turn away, just not be silent when we see it happening.
Well, Derek Black has been our guest for the hour. They're author of the new book, The Klansman's Son. That's out and available now, well worth the read. Derek Black, a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. And thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll go out as we do on Thursdays with Leo T. and Skywatcher. Thanks, everyone.
It's One Sky, Many Cultures. Skywatcher Leo T. here. Did you happen to catch the Leo T. report on the celestial triangle hanging in the east last week, comprising of Jupiter, Mars, and Aldebaran? Or see it, as Kathy did on the way to Pilates at 5 in the morning? Well, the planet and big orange star are continuing their cosmic game of pool, with Mars and Jupiter passing each other on the 14th. And they're in conjunction on the 17th. Mars and Jupiter shine 1 degree apart, with Aldebaran watching nearby. All of them are hanging in the east an hour before sunrise, about 45 degrees above the mountains. In the night, as Vegas shines nearest the zenith right after dark now, Sagittarius Teapot is at its highest down in the south, tipping with the steam of the Milky Way coming out. 2 hours later, when Bright Deneb passes the zenith, it's the turn of the little UFO. It looks just like a UFO, or Delphinus the Dolphin, at its highest point due south, leaping in and out of the Milky Way, as I always like to say. Check it out. Looks like an old-fashioned UFO if you have the right stuff. And closer to home, geomagnetic storms and solar flares have charged up the aurora around the world this week during the peak of the Perseid meteor shower. How lucky are stargazers who saw both around the world? And as we see some amazing photos grace the Skywatcher Leo T. Facebook page from this, one from the outer space and the ISS with a Russian Soyuz spacecraft in front of an aurora, as captured by NASA astronaut Matthew Dominic, August 2nd. As Aurora's dancing behind the Russian Soyuz spacecraft on the orbiting complex, astronaut Dominic wrote that recent solar activity pushed the aurora closer to us. The Soyuz hangs from the station in a stream of aurora. Check it out. Also, we have photos from Northern Lights over Alberta, Canada, and a couple others in there, so check those out. We're keeping an eye and our senses above to one of my go-to places, the Corona Borealis, for a nova eruption coming soon. This is between the stars and the semicircle of the Chiefs, or the Northern Crown, as it's also called. This is off the coast and above Big Orange Arcturus, to the left of the handle of the Big Dipper. Astrophysicists say the white dwarf of this double star, which includes a red giant, could blow at any time. Energy is pulled onto the white dwarf from the red giant until the dwarf blasts up a bunch of star stuff into space. Stay tuned. In the meantime, let's take a look at the swan overhead in the summer triangle. Cygnus, the beautiful crystalline summer swan with star trails, doubles, and remnants of novas and supernovas like the Vale Nebula, which astronomers love to show you at a star viewing. Also, on the left of the triangle is Cygnus's brightest star, Deneb. If you have a dark sky, it's easy to see the edgewise view into the galaxy, spun across the heavens. Cygnus contains one of the stargazer's favorite double stars in the sky, blue and gold Albireo. These two orbit each other and they are millions of miles away. When you look at the swan, you look edgewise and at the depths of the Milky Way. And the swan in sky lore, where it's many cultures, one sky. Amongst the star lore, the mythology of Cygnus tells the story of Zeus, who changed into the form of a swan to entice Queen Leda. From their union came the twins Castor and Pollux, from the constellation Gemini, the twins. The swan also represents delicate beauty in many cultures around the globe, from Native American to Slavic. In Greek mythology, the swan song is the beautiful song sung by the swan just before death. It is also a reminder of how beautiful life is on planet Earth. Keep looking up, feel the magic, and get just a little bit lost in space. Skywatcher Leo T.